Blog Talk Radio.
All right, welcome everybody, and welcome to Ron Brooks Show. I'm glad you're joining me today.
Talk.
And I've got a bunch of topics I want to talk about. I think some of them are, I think you'll find particularly interesting. Man, I don't know, are we live on Facebook yet? All right, if you guys missed me on Facebook, sorry. Lately, I've been terrible at this stuff. We got a bunch of topics. The first one we're going to be talking about is an announcement that I got not that long ago. I saw it on Facebook and then listened to it from Jordan Peterson and from Dave Rubin, and that they are in the process, I guess, so in the early stages of launching a Patreon alternative. So you can go and find the video of the discussion about it on the Rubin Report. It was posted earlier today. And it's a little unclear in terms of what exactly they'll be launching, but it sounds like Jordan Peterson has been working on for a while an alternative, not just to Patreon, but I think more broadly, an alternative for Twitter and Facebook and a variety of different, maybe even YouTube, a variety of different online platforms, getting ready for the day where he might be kicked off. So as I've mentioned in the past, I've always thought that if things got bad enough, that there will be alternatives, that alternatives will arise. I don't believe in barriers to entry. I don't believe the government has granted these companies in Silicon Valley any special powers, any guns that would allow the creation of barriers to entry. I've always believed that if you could figure out a model, and I've talked about this, if you could figure out a model how to launch a competitor to all of these things, to all of these platforms, then capital will be available to do it. And from everything Dave and Jordan described in their brief conversation, it seems like they're not short on capital. They're not short on programmers. They've got an idea, and it sounds like they might even be launching something in the next week or so. So I don't know what it's going to look like. I don't know what it's going to be. I have texted Dave Rubin to tell him that I'm interested, and whether I can be of help and whether I can be one of the people who starts out on that platform would be great. But stay tuned. I think it's going to be interesting. You know, we'll see. I'm a little worried that Jordan and maybe Dave don't quite realize the complexity that's involved in launching such a platform. So I'm a little wary. As Roy says on the chat here, online payment gateways are a nightmare. And I think everything about these platforms turns out to be a nightmare. It's complicated. It's difficult. Payment, excuse me, more than anything else. But I think the fact that Jordan Peterson, who probably brings in well over $1 million a year on Patreon, maybe several million dollars a year on Patreon, I don't know. Last time, I think it was public, he was bringing in, I think, over $80,000 a month. And that was a long time ago. Just him threatening to withdraw from Patreon is going to have to scare Patreon. I mean, I'm fairly certain he is the largest provider of revenue through Patreon. I can't think of any celebrity who generates more revenue through Patreon than Jordan Peterson. So just the fact that he's threatening to withdraw and is going to withdraw is incredibly meaningful. Again, capitalism markets. Even capitalism with its hands tied behind its back and one broken leg and, barely out there, capitalism is an amazing thing. Capitalism works. And if there's a demand and if companies abuse the economic power that they have, if companies misprice their product or provide a service that is not really desirable by people, alternatives will arise. And I think we're seeing the first indication that such an alternative is going to be created. I think that both Jordan and Dave are well connected enough to get the kind of resources they need to be able to pull this off. Again, I think it's probably going to be more complicated and difficult than what they expect. I hope I'm wrong. So it might take longer than what they expect. But, you know, they were saying they'd launch something, maybe a beta in a week. But, hey, even if it takes 3 months, it doesn't matter. This is going to be huge, and it'll shake up, particularly if they can create a platform that is both monetizes and is a Facebook, Twitter kind of replacement. Now, you don't get the economy of scale that you do with those platforms, but, you know, you have to start somewhere. And if they can create something like that, something organic, something integrated like that, it could really change the industry. And if you get all of the intellectual dark web moving all at once, I think it becomes an incredibly powerful platform and an incredibly powerful place. And then it's a question of, can you convince other people outside of that network to join? And I think if you create an enticing enough package, then hopefully that'll happen. Because the last thing you want is to create more echo chambers where people are just talking to one another. You want to create an open platform like Facebook and like Twitter. What I found interesting was there was a little point in the conversation between Jordan and Dave where it sounds like they have talked about, well, what are going to be the standards, right? Because they understand that they have to be some standards, that to have a legit platform, to have a platform that is big enough, substantial enough, and ultimately successful enough, you have to have some standards. And it's interesting. It's going to be interesting to see if they can put together, and I'm going to encourage them to the extent that anybody listens to me, I'm going to encourage them to put together standards that are clear, objective, well-defined, that people know when they're in violation of those standards and when they're not. Because I think that is what is really missing from Facebook. That's what's missing from Twitter. That's what's missing from Patreon. That's what is missing from YouTube. Clear, objective, clearly defined guidelines for what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. If it's never acceptable anywhere on the web to use the N-word, and if you do use the N-word anywhere in the web, you're going to be dropped from Patreon, then okay, that'd be good to know in advance. And then you can make your own calculations. I don't think that's particularly objective. I don't think that makes any sense as a standard, but if that's the standard, because Sagar Avakad supposedly was dropped because he used the N-word in some conversation. He was using it against the kind of alt-right neo-Nazi types. So he was using it against them, so he wasn't using it derogatory, but still, he used it on somebody else's platform in some other interview. And then out of nowhere, months later, he gets dropped from Patreon, his source of revenue for his business. I mean, one of the things that that Dave Rubin was mentioning, which is true of him and it's true of a lot of us, is that Patreon is a huge percentage of our revenue, of our income. And for them to just unilaterally drop you without warning and without any kind of knowledge or risk that you might be dropped because you might know that you violated something or you understand the standards. You don't even understand the standards. It just ran out of nowhere, a bolt of lightning. I mean, that's just not right. And it's right for an alternative. Greg on Facebook mentions that it should have an adjudication process. Absolutely. So there has to be a method of appeal. Say, wait a minute. No. I didn't exactly. That's not what I said. Or think of the context or, you know, whatever it happens to be. But I think clear, objective guidelines with an adjudication process and a clear, again, objective adjudication process is what's required. Now, to some extent, I don't 100%, you know, I'm sympathetic to Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and some of these platforms. And I know many of you are not, but I'm sympathetic to the extent that I think it's hard to come up with objective standards. I think it's hard to do, and particularly it's hard to do when you're inventing something completely new and you can't think of all the cases and you have to. So I think it's easier today than it was 5 years ago. It was easier 2 years ago than 5 years ago. It's still easier today than 2 years ago. It's easier today than a week ago. You know, what happened to Salgan is a real wake-up call in a sense of how arbitrary the standards is. Oh, I mean, this is very different, I think, than Alex Jones and a lot of the others, where there was a whole body of work that was being evaluated in a particular way. Salgan, it was one word in one interview on one occasion, taken out of context, and seemingly based on what the CEO had said and based on what others said, in contradiction to the own standards that they had conveyed. So it's a difficult thing to do, to come up with standards, to imagine the kind of cases that could occur, to figure out how to apply them. And that's just why Greg's point is so important. It's why it's so important to have an adjudication process, because you might get it wrong. And an adjudication process, an appeal process, well, it would allow you to correct errors that you have made, would allow you to correct, to refine, to improve the standards. And I think that would happen. I don't think you'd come up with one standard and they would hold forever. These were standards that would evolve with experience and would evolve over time as you learned what to do. So I'm really excited about what they have in mind. I'm waiting to see what it is and how it looks. As I said, I've contacted Dave Rubin to try to get more information. Also expect next year to see more events with the Ayn Rand Institute and Dave Rubin. There's some exciting, I think, stuff that's going to happen. I'm going to be on doing some things with Dave. I don't quite see the Ben Shapiro thing happening. Ben is won't commit and seems to constantly find excuses. So that doesn't look like it's going to happen. But other exciting things with Dave Rubin are going to happen. So stay tuned for that. And that plus this new platform that they're talking about, whether it's a payment platform or a bigger platform than just a payment platform, bodes well for 2019 of being a very exciting year for everything that we are doing and everything that we're trying to do. And getting ideas out there and getting real conversations out there and raising money for these ideas and having a platform to make a living off of these ideas. So I'm excited. I hope you guys are too. And it's good news. And go to Rubin's platform and check it out. Check it out yourself and check it out what they talked about. So as I get more information, as more information becomes public, I will let you know. Let me take a couple of super chat questions here. And remember, if you have a question for me, I see some of you already have questions. The way to do that is to ask them on the super chat. Do you have an opinion on Sajid Javid, UK Home Secretary and favorite to be the next Conservative Party leader and potential future PM? He's an Ayn Rand fan. I know he's an Ayn Rand fan. I didn't know he was the favorite to be the party leader and a future prime minister. That's interesting, and that's exciting just because he's an Ayn Rand fan. I don't know beyond that much. As Home Secretary, I don't know that he's done anything good or anything particularly bad. Some of the political correctness comes out of the Home Secretary's office, and I don't know if he's reversed any of that or been better on those kind of issues. But now that you mention him as potentially a PM, I'll do a little bit of more research about him and maybe talk about it on a future show. If you have any information about him or a good article about him or know what he's done as the UK Home Secretary, please send me some info. I'd be happy to do the research and give you my ideas about it. Why is suicide moral in a concentration camp? Wouldn't the moral and just action in that context be to die trying to kill a god or escape? Well, it depends, right? I mean, you have to have the energy to kill a god. You have to have the energy to escape both the I don't think you can really muster the energy to escape unless you think there's some chance of being successful. Some chance of being successful. Now, I'm very sympathetic to the idea of killing a god. And, it's not so much about suicide, but because I think the people who commit suicide after, you know, there weren't the people taken into the gas chambers. The people who went into the gas chambers kind of just walked in there. And that I could never understand. That seems bizarre to me. But I think, you know, they're so psychologically being oppressed and subjugated that they can't imagine an alternative. And of course, my approach, my view is if I'm going to go into gas chambers anyway, yeah, I'm going to take God with me. I think contemplating suicide, getting to the point of suicide is, wow. I mean, that's a point where you're broken, where you've given up, where I don't know that you have the physical or the psychological energy to kill a God. And at that point, what difference does it make? You know, you're not trying to send a message to the world. At that point, you've given up on life. Life is zero. It doesn't exist. You're not going to get any momentary satisfaction of it because the world, you've given up on the world. It's not even that you've given up on your life. You've given up on the world as such. Killing a God makes no difference. Resistance at this point makes no difference. So, and again, there's no, once you've given up on life, once you've abandoned life as a value, and there is no immoral, I mean, you die in whatever way is feasible to you. And if life is so painful, if everything about life is so painful psychologically and physically, that it's completely unbearable, as it would be in a concentration camp, where you have no food, your gods beat you, they constantly create psychological havoc. I think Schindler's List does a great job, horrific, but great job in illustrating kind of the randomness and the injustice and just the sheer brutality and randomness of what the prison gods would do to people to break their spirit, to break their will, to break their humanity, to break any form of valuing, And if what's left is either to stay alive and work for the Nazis, stay alive or just suffer, or commit suicide. And I completely understand those people who committed suicide. I can understand those people who try to kill a god. I can understand those people who try to escape. I can understand those people who sustain through it and live through it all. I think all are viable moral options. I don't think any one of those is an immoral option given the alternative. Given the situation that you're in. All right, here's another question. Are you having another discussion with Jordan Peterson at Ocon? You know, I wouldn't be surprised if I had another discussion with Jordan Peterson at some point. I doubt that it would be at Ocon, but at some point possibly. And I'm not sure I'm the right – I've said this before. I'm not sure I'm the right person to have a conversation with Jordan Peterson. Jordan goes very quickly, very deep to issues of epistemology that I disagree with and would argue with, but I'm probably not the best person to disagree with and argue with. I just don't know the epistemology well enough. Now, if he's stuck just to ethics, then yes, I would be happy to debate Jordan Peterson on ethics. I'd be happy to debate Jordan Peterson on politics, on economics. But once you get to epistemology and metaphysics, I know I disagree with him. I know what my arguments would be to disagree with him, but I'm not quick in my feet on those topics, quick enough to be able to challenge him to the extent and the depth that he needs to be challenged. So I'd love to see an objectivist like Greg or like Ankar, take Jordan Peterson on directly on these epistemological and metaphysical issues. I'll stick to things that I know a little bit more about, which tend to be more in the area of ethics and politics. All right. Take a break from Super Chat questions. If you want to ask a question, feel free to use the Super Chat feature and ask away. All right. The next the next topic is just mind-boggling and insane and ridiculous, and I don't know exactly what to do about it. But I came across this from Paul McKeever, who's an objectivist in Canada, and on his Facebook page on this article. An article says, and the title of the article, and first, when I read it first, I thought, no, this is like fake news. This is some like Onion piece. This is some ridiculous thing. And it is true that the title is a bit more crazy than the actual content, but it's still insane. The actual content is still insane. But I thought this was so nuts that it couldn't be true. So I did a bit of a Google search, and it's like this appeared in every newspaper in Canada, and then appeared in all the British newspapers. So I figure, and then if you go and you can find the actual documents from the school district, so this is actually true. And this is the title. Now, the title is a little there to provoke, but that's what titles are there for. And this is what the title says. 8-year-old pupils to be told boys can have periods too under new sex education lessons guidelines. Yeah, you heard that right. The new education guidelines, the new sex education guidelines, in order not to discriminate between boys and girls, are telling in the class, they are being told, that boys can have periods too. Now, for a while there, I thought, no, okay, this is completely nuts. What are they talking about? Boys can have periods. I mean, boys can't have periods. I mean, that's just... And it took me a while, because it's so convoluted and so weird what they're actually saying. It took me a while to figure out what they actually mean, because they talk about transgenders and, all right, but what does that have to do with boys? Boys can't have periods. Boys, you know, if you have a penis, you don't have a period. That's about it. You need certain infrastructure, biological infrastructure, to have a period. And I think what they mean, and, you know, ultimately what I got from this is, and they won't say it exactly, because they can't be too explicit. They can't actually say what they mean. Being vague and being misleading is part of how they get away with this crap. What they mean is that a girl who identifies herself as a boy, who might be in the boys' locker room, could have a period. Now, that is true. Biologically, I originally thought they were just, you know, even denying biology. But as I read, I realized that no, what they're doing is they're not denying that aspect of biology. They might be denying other aspects of biology. They're not denying that. They're just recognizing the fact that if you accept that prepubescent child who is a girl can identify as a boy, and a prepubescent boy who can identify as a girl, and that is legitimate, that is legit, and that they should be treated that way, then it recognizes the fact that you've got a real problem, because girls who identify as boys are going to have periods, and the boys around them I'm not going to know what to do, because, hey, I, at age 12, I don't think I knew exactly. I didn't know what a period was. I had no idea. So this girl who identifies the boy is not surrounded by girls who might be able to help them understand what it is. They're now surrounded by boys who have no clue and who are probably shocked by the whole thing and probably, therefore, are going to behave in not so nice ways towards this girl who's identified as a boy who's not bleeding and having menstruation. So now what they're doing is they're teaching this to 8-year-olds that boys can have periods too. Ah, I mean, the insanity of it. No, boys by definition do not menstruate. One of the things that makes a woman biologically, is that she menstruates, that she has a period. One of the things that that men who identify as women will never experience, and that's why they can never be fully female, is having a period. Now, I've never had one, so I don't know the full experience, but you know, living around a woman, I can tell you, it's an experience. It's time-consuming, energy-consuming, hormone-consuming, hormone-influencing. It's an experience, one way or the other. Negative, positive, it's an experience that only women can have. Only biological women can have. And it doesn't matter what you identify yourself with. Now you can have all that mechanism taken out and have something rebuilt down there that, and then you can pretend to be a man. I think that's a lot easier than the other way around. But as long as you have that biology, that's what you are. And I'm not denying here, that certain people who are born women, even in adulthood, feel like they should be a man. Feelings are not primary, one. Two, even if there's some biological basis to that, hormones, something else, something going on in the brain, it doesn't make them a man. It makes them feel like they want to be a man. It makes them feel like a man, but it doesn't make them a man. And the same with the other way around. And I feel sorry for them. I think it's horrible, 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 whether it's biological, psychological, whatever the cause is. To be of one gender, feel like you should be of another gender. I can't imagine because sex is so important. And clearly knowing who you are and clearly knowing who you're attracted to is so important. So important. That it's sad. If you can't do that, if you don't know how to identify yourself, if you don't feel a complete man or a complete woman, if you're torn or if you've got a body of one and you think you should be something else. I mean, all of those are real psychological issues and real problems, and I feel sorry for those people. It's really, really problematic, and they shouldn't be made fun of. They should be ridiculed, and certainly they have a right to live their life with dignity, and they have a right, all the rights that any other individual has, but they don't have more rights than that. And it's not, you can't just ignore biological reality. And there is a certain biological reality. Now, I do know a man who turned himself into a woman, a famous economist. I actually mentioned her on the show a while ago. And I've spent some time with her now. She transitioned to being a female, and she's quite old, and she's delightful and funny and amazing. And, you know, we disagree very fundamentally on lots of issues. Philosophically, we're not aligned, although we're aligned up to a point, more aligned than a lot of intellectuals are. And she's more open to our ideas than many intellectuals are, but she's religious and she's lots of other things and she's wrong about a lot of things, but she's a delight to be with. And I consider her a she because she's changed the biology in enough ways. And that's what she wants to be called. And that's what she dresses as. And that's what she behaves as, that she's a she, right? Who was a he. And she's funny about it. She talks about it. She's got a sense of humor about it. So, and I think it's cost her a lot to make that transition. It's not a simple thing to have done. But okay, as an adult, you have a lot of ways in which you can deal with these things. But let me say this again, as long as your biology is what it is, that's what you are. Children should not have a choice. Children should not have a choice. Children should not be making these kind of decisions. It is absurd and ridiculous to expect children 8 years old to understand sexuality, anything about sexuality, anything about gender other than they are boys and they are girls. And a boy who feels like a girl and a girl who feels like a boy at eighth grade or 8 years old or eight-year-olds is absurd. It's ridiculous. It's bizarre. Maybe as teenagers, late teens. It's nuts. And to cultivate this and to embrace this and to make it part of the curriculum, for God's sake, is absolutely absurd. Yes, there are plenty of little girls who are tomboys, and who want to be boys. Lots of them. Lots of them, particularly given the way girls are treated and the way boys are often treated. A lot of girls would like to be boys because they can be like to be treated like boys because boys are generally treated better in some way, at least. And it's a travesty. Travesty to appease that. And it's not surprised that what you get is a generation of emotional spewing young adults who are told that anything they feel at any point in their life is okay. Children are not developed enough cognitively, biologically, sexually to have an opinion about these things. They can tell mommy, I feel this way, fine. And if it sustains itself, maybe you should, you know, as a parent, you should consider it and think about it. And I don't know. I don't know enough about the condition. But to take it seriously enough to give them hormones or to let a girl be in a boy's locker room or a boy be in a girl's locker room because they identify at the age of 8 with some other sex is absurd and ridiculous. Unfair to the child, never mind to all the other children. And it enshrines subjectivism. So I don't think we have a good biological, scientific grasp on what's going on with transgenderism. But I certainly don't think that we should embrace this idea that we should teach 8-year-olds and we should teach children that there are no differences between genders and, you know, menstruation is inclusive. The teacher, the advisor says, menstruation must be inclusive of all genders. No. Only those with the biology of a woman, of a girl, can menstruate. Boys cannot menstruate. They cannot. It's one of the things that makes a girl a girl. The new advice following a council report which says trans boys and men and non-binary people, how can you be non-binary as a child, may have periods. No, they can't. Men can't have periods. Menstruations must be inclusive of all genders. Bins, listen to this. Bins used for menstruation products will be provided in all toilets for children, according to the report. Unbelievable. Just unbelievable. The subjectivism that we have come to in the world in which we live. In the world in which we live. This is what the council says in a statement. By encouraging effective education on menstruation and puberty, we hope to reduce stigma and ensure no child or young person feels shame in asking for period products inside or outside of school if they need them. Well, that's all fine. Although, again, I don't think 8-year-olds need to learn, have sex education classes. I'm not sure what they're thinking. You know, maybe girls are starting to menstruate at 8. I don't know. But this is primarily something the parents should be dealing with, not the schools. Not every parent wants their kids told the actual details of menstruation, of sex, and everything else. And of course, as Doron mentions, generally trans children are very, very, very rare. Very rare. Okay. As one of the critics says, critics of this policy says, learning about periods is already a difficult subject for children of that age, of any age really. So to throw in the idea, girls who believe that they are boys also have periods, will leave them completely confused. Absolutely. However, the article says, leading doctors have previously recommended that primary school children are taught about LGBT issues. No, no, no. I mean, that's just absurd that young children should be taught about these issues. Now, you know, the only reason I can think of is in the culture in which we live in, these issues rise to the surface and kids are exposed to them at a very young age. And but it'd be good then if they just got objective information and objective knowledge about it instead of the kind of subjectivism that is perpetrated by, I think, this recommendation and other recommendations like it. All right. I'm sure I'm going to get a bunch of hate mail on this one. But I can't believe the title of this article. 8-year-old pupils to be told boys can have periods too. It takes quite something to get to that. All right. We've got three super chat questions. Okay. Are sex offender registries a violation of individual rights and objectivity of law? Why don't bank robbers have to have their names in a registry for life once they get out of prison? Well, I mean, I've never heard this question before, so let me think about it. And I've never thought about sex registries. I do think there's a difference. And the primary difference is the ease by which sex offenders can commit their crimes, the horrific nature of the crime, the fact that the crime is often motivated by psychological issues that often are not completely dealt with by the time they were out of prison. Now, let me just be clear. In my view, somebody who commits violent rape, certainly somebody who commits violent rape more than once, should be put in jail and the keys should be thrown away. Right? I mean, it should be maybe not life, because you don't want to give the rapist an incentive to murder because the penalty is the same. Because I don't, if I don't believe in a death penalty, then life in prison would be the death penalty. But it should be a long death. It should be a long sentence. And I'm not necessarily opposed to castration, although, you know, I can be talked in and out of it. So I'm willing to be talked. I find sex offenses so horrific that the idea of violent rape is one of the most horrific crimes there is, right? Now, if you are let out, and I don't have a problem with sex registries. I mean, I certainly would want to know if there's somebody who'd been committed, who'd been let out, who was a sex offender, and I was raising a family and had some children. I would want to know that. And I think, look, when you violate somebody's rights in a violent fashion like that, you lose your rights. You have no rights. Now, it's quite reasonable to say bank robbers should have a registry, maybe that the bank could access or something. But bank robbers are unlikely to it's not easy for them to repeat offend, and it's not as quite as the word. It doesn't affect the neighborhood, your neighbors, the people you live around, quite in the same way. So, you know, I think sex offenders are unique here. Murderers are not let loose. I think if somebody is a somebody beats up people and keeps getting released out of jail after beating up people in the neighborhood, I think a registry of people like that makes sense. Again, I'd prefer just to throw away the keys or to put them in jail for a very long time. I think violent crime generally, we probably don't, the penalty is probably not harsh enough. But no, I don't have any problem of sex. And it can be a violation of individual rights, because you have no rights. You have no rights. Once you commit a violent crime, you have no rights. And the idea is that at that point, I can impose on you a sentence that includes that for the rest of your life, you're in a registry. Okay. Should you have to verbally warn somebody to get off your property before shooting them during a home invasion? Or is it moral to shoot them with no warning? What about on the street if you have a CCL? I don't know what a CCL is. Maybe you can tell me what a CCL is. I mean, it depends on the context. So if there is a chance that the purpose that somebody is coming to your property by accident, I don't know, middle of the night and the door was unlocked and they walked in. But if they've broken in, no, I don't think you you need a warrant. If somebody's broken in, if somebody's smashed the window, you don't have to find out if they're carrying a gun. You don't have to find out if they have peaceful intentions. You don't have to find out if they just wanted to rob you, if they wanted to rape your children as well. You shoot them and ask questions later. So a home invasion where somebody has broken in and it's unquestioned, then. Now, if somebody is walking along across your lawn, you can't shoot them. I mean, you have to warn them first. Again, it's context, right? They haven't done anything violent, like breaking a window or, you know, breaking a lock or breaking in some way. They haven't broken anything walking along or even if there's a fence. You know, a lot of times children will do a shortcut and they'll go through a fence yard. You're not going to shoot anybody, and they're not risk. Your life is not at risk. That is the reason. If it's a home invasion, you should shoot first. Is your life is at risk. Bodily harm is, there's a real reason for to assume bodily harm. Okay, so what about on the street if you have a concealed weapons? I mean, yeah, if you have a concealed carry license, then you should only shoot somebody if your life or somebody else's life is in danger. That is, if they're running at you with a knife, or they're pointing a gun at you, or they're drawing a gun at you, or they've just shot somebody else, or they're threatening somebody else. So there has to be a credible threat to your life. That's the standard by which. Now, I think breaking into your house is a credible threat to your life. I don't think somebody walking across your lawn is a credible threat to your life. I don't think somebody yelling at you is a credible threat to your life. I don't think somebody even, you know, swearing at you. They'd have to threaten in a way that was credible. And I still think that if you can walk away, that should always be the right option. Walk away and call the police. Even if you have a concealed weapon, walk away and call the police. The last thing you want to do is actually shoot somebody. And one of the things you discover when you try and shoot somebody is, even though on the in the shooting range you're a great shot, when you actually have a human being in front of you, you might miss. And if you miss, and they're a real bad guy, they're not going to miss. They're going to get you. So the best policy, in confronted with somebody on the street, you know, given that they're not pointing a gun at you or they're not running at you with a knife, but if there's a way to walk away, then walk away. Walk away. Right? That should be option number one, is always run. Unless you're fully trained and you know exactly what you're doing and you know that you've got the upper hand. Your life is too valuable to make a stand for the sake of some false pride, some false concept of pride. All right. Where do you guys come up with these questions? Time warp, really? You know, but he put money to it, so here goes. In an objectivist society, should you be free to walk around your house naked with all your curtains open? Have intercourse with curtains open? I suspect the answer is yes. You would be free to do that. If your neighbors don't like it, and I guess it depends on how good looking you are, then they will find ways to make it clear to you that you should stop. I think if your neighbors come to you and said, look, our kids, we've got kids, and you know, this isn't the way they should learn about sex, is by watching you and whatever, I think the right thing to do is to stop. I think the moral thing to do is to stop. The decent thing to do is to stop. I think nudity, I think we make too big of a deal out of nudity. I don't see the big deal in nudity. So I don't think walking around your house naked should be a big problem. Now, it's funny because our neighbors, our neighbors in California, where we lived, I think before they got to know us, maybe even after, they called our house the nude house. The nude house. Not because we would walk around nude in the house, although maybe we did that, but not because of that. But because of all the sculptures and the paintings of nudes in the house. And I think the kids on occasion would come to the house and, whoa, you know, we didn't know. And they would see all the paintings and the sculptures of nude men, women, and it's shocking. It's surprising to people. People don't usually do that. They don't usually put paintings like that on the wall. And with us, it's everywhere, and you can actually look through the glass from the street, and you can see this male nude sculpture, this life-size male nude sculpture, right standing there. You know, you can see it kind of vaguely because it's behind the glass, but you can see it. So our house was the nude house. But I think in Western civilization, because of Christianity, we make way too much out of nudity. You know, the sinfulness of nudity or the evil of nudity. I think generally Christianity has had a very, very negative effect on our attitude towards sex, towards the human body. Remember that athletes in the Olympics in Greece competed naked, wrestled naked. Obviously not a homophobic society. I certainly think sex, you know, is maybe questionable. It certainly would stop doing it. Now, Greg points out that Rand's view was that this sort of thing, and I think she was talking primarily about pornography. I don't know about your behavior, but pornography and walking around the streets, certainly, but that shown in public, like, you know, billboards showing sex or sex shops displaying vivid, that there could be laws against that. And I remember in her article about pornography, she talks about that you know, if people, you can't just splash it in people's face. You can't just put it out there in people's face. And certainly if you're walking down the street naked, I mean, the owners of the street would obviously regulate that in some way. And I think that given the government is the owner in some way of the street, there can be laws against that. Whether in your house where people can see through the windows, I don't know. I don't know that she used that specific example. Greg, if I'm mistaken, please correct me. I think that's different. You know, again, okay, somebody masturbating in the house in front of the window. So if you're masturbating in the house in front of the window where everybody can, you know, it's just there. It sounds like they have to make an effort to see you, but you're right there in front of them. Then yeah, I can see that there'd be laws against that. But I think there's a difference between nudity and masturbation and intercourse. I think there's a difference between your house and the windows happen to be open and somebody could sneak a glance in versus you being an exhibitionist displaying it all to the world. I think there are nuances here that would have to be worked out. But again, I think there's way too much done out of nudity. I don't think there would be as big of a deal in an objective society. Greg says she didn't use that example, but I think the principle is if you're doing it in a way where people on other properties can easily see you without making a special effort, then yeah. So you'd have to have some category where it's in their face. Then it would be wrong. And again, I don't know. I'm not sure whether that would apply to nudity or not. Leonard has, I remember Leonard had a discussion on limitations, on nudity generally. He was pro it. I think he used to talk about going to the nude beach in San Diego during the Objectivist conferences back in the old days when they were in San Diego. He used to go to Black's Beach. And he talks about what kind of limitations would be in public nudity, under what circumstances. Again, I don't know if he talked about this specific example of a home, but I think Greg's right. If you're in people's face, or if it can be seen so easily as to disturb people, then yes, you can imagine certain regulations of it. I'd try to find what Leonard Peikoff said about it. He's always incredibly insightful about these things. It's in his podcast somewhere. I don't remember exactly what he said. I remember it from his, I think he talked about it a TJS, a Thomas Jefferson School, the precursor of Ocon. I think he talked about 1987 when I was there because he had gone to Black's Beach. And so he talked a little bit about nude beaches, at least in that show. All right. Is Europe more open about nudity? Yeah, I think Europe is more open about nudity. You can go to parks in the summertime in places like Germany and Northern Europe, and you can find people sunbathing in the nude. Nude beaches are much, much more common all over Europe. And there's certainly aesthetically, that can be very displeasing, but, yeah, there's much more public nudity in Europe than there is in the United States. United States is prudish. It's generally much more influenced in this realm, in the realm of sex and in the realm of body, than Europe is. Much more influenced by Christianity, the U.S. is, as a consequence. So, yeah, I mean, in Europe, you see a lot more of it. I remember going when I was a teenager to the beaches in the Sinai Desert in Dahab and Nueva, and all these European women, Northern European women would, well, not just women, men, but I paid attention only to the women, would vacation there. It was, you know, because it was always warm there, and so you could come in the winter. And it would be one long stretch of miles and miles and miles of basically nude beach. Teenage heaven for a boy, you know, at the time. So, but you saw a lot of European women. You didn't see American women, and you saw some Israeli women. So, anyway. Wow, this is a hard one, Michael. So you're asking, what is a rational way to recover from a loss of a spouse or a child? I don't know. Well, it's hard right now. Let me say I'm going to defer on that. A really, really good friend of mine, just let me know yesterday that his son committed suicide. So I don't know that I can talk about this topic without getting emotional in a way that I don't want to get. And I don't know that I have an answer because it's, you know, I'm getting emotional already. That contemplating it is just too difficult. So I don't think it's appropriate given the mental state I'm in right now. Okay. So let's skip. Now, this is a kid that I knew when he was a baby and I don't want to get into it. Okay. So the episode, Leonard's episode is titled, Is There a Rational Basis for Not Being Comfortable with Public Nudity? Is there a rational basis for not being comfortable with public nudity? And Leonard talks about that. So, Brittany says that in Germany, it's not just the nude beaches, but it's also swimming pools. But I remember even in the public parks, when it's a hot summer day, people will take off all their clothes and just lie in the sun. And, you know, so, okay. All right. I am going to, so, Michael, sorry, I'm not going to answer the question, but ask it again or send me an email and remind me to ask it again. I'll answer it in a future episode and I'll think about what I would actually say. All right, here's another story I wanted to cover today. It's a little complicated because it's a very mixed story. But I don't know if you saw the video of this Columbia University student, physics student, who was taped, and the video went viral. Yelling and screaming these white supremacist rants about how. You know, and they are white supremacists. He talked about how proud he was of being white and whites had changed the world and, whites created civilization and he was, and nobody else had. And we white people invented the modern world. And right? You know, we, again, white people, invented science and industry, and you went to tell us to stop because, oh my God, we're so bad. And he goes on and on and on. I mean, on and on for a couple of minutes in the video. I'm not sure how long the video is exactly. With this rant, and he's jumping up and down, and he's obviously very excited and so on. And it's really, I mean, I have to say, it's horrible. And it's inexcusable, and it's wrong, and it's offensive, and all of that. But what's omitted from the video is the context, And the context is just as vile, right? And the context is, at least according to him, right? So he has come out with a public statement, but which is interesting, because nobody else is carrying this. I've tried to look for it. I found it in a couple of news sources. One, it disappeared. It was listed, but then I can't find it. His name is Von Ebel, and he's supposedly a brilliant, a physics student. And he says that he had been approached by a group of students who were harassing him about white privilege, were harassing him, was saying something that he couldn't. He says, a large group of students gathered around me and told me that I had no right to share my views on women as I'm a white male with white privilege. Now, I consider the whole idea of white privilege racist and offensive and disgusting. And the whole idea that a male can't comment on women, and that if you're white, you can't comment on somebody who's not white, and that everybody is categorized based on these intersectionality categories, I find offensive and disgusting. And, you know, the reaction to that should never be racism, right? The reaction to racism should never be racism. He writes that, I'm not a white supremacist or racist, although he comes across as one, nor do I subscribe to any views that support that ideology. I unequivocally denounce all groups that support racism. Good. And he says, my reaction that evening grew out of my distaste for the overuse of the term white privilege and similar divisive rhetoric as a means of dismissing views of others. Now, you know, I think the fact that it's divisive is the least of our problems. But I get that he was angry. I get that he was pissed off. I am too, and I'm told that all my views are a consequence of my white privilege all the time. And it's offensive, and it's disgusting, and it wants me to get really, really mad and yell at people. And it's okay to get really, really mad and yell at people, as long as you don't yell back at them equally disgusting things. You, my boy, did not create Western civilization. You, my boy, have nothing to do with science and technology, everything that has to do with civilization. You didn't do it. You didn't build the modern world. People who maybe look a little bit like you did, who cares? You didn't. Don't take credit for something you didn't do. You didn't invent the modern world. You didn't build modern civilization. The fact that somebody else had the same color skin as you did is irrelevant to anything. So yes, get angry about the term white privilege. Yes, get furious when you're told that you should not be able to comment on issues because of the color of your skin or because of your gender. Yes, you should get angry. Yes, you should be pissed off. Yes, you should argue against that point of view. But to argue against that point of view from the perspective of racism, from the perspective of collectivism and tribalism, makes you as bad as them. Makes you as bad as them. Now, I think the fact that the media is so selective in terms of what they published, and they haven't published the whole story, and that they don't publish the occurrences of racism from the other side, that they're not offended by the idea of white privilege and the constant, if you go on campuses and you go online, and the constant barrage of attacks that are done in the name of white privilege, and you can't discuss issues because of who you are and the color of your skin. The fact that the media and others don't recognize that as racism is a real problem. But again, you do not become a racist in order to combat it. This is the problem with the alt-right. The alt-right supposedly is offended by identity politics. And their solution to identity politics is to embrace identity politics. That's disgusting. It's irrational. It doesn't make any sense. The color of your skin is an accidental, insignificant feature of who you are. And you, by being white, do not share anything in achievements of other people who happen to be white, whether they're born with you right now or born in previous generations. Even if they were your ancestor, you don't share in their achievements. Even if you have a direct genetic link to them, you don't share in their achievements. Debates and discussions, right? And I really appreciate this. As an objectivist, the best way I can thank you for enriching my life with value is with my wallet. Thank you. And the wallet is huge. But the fact that you say thank you, the fact that you guys often say thank you for the work I do, is equal to what you do with your wallet. So thank you for recognizing the fact that I provide value. I appreciate that. That's all I want to say about the Columbia students. I'm gonna leave it at that. I've got a couple of other stories I wanted to cover, but I'll cover them maybe tomorrow. Tomorrow I'm not going to do a show, but I'll do a show with Amy on Tuesday, and then probably a show on Wednesday and Thursday. So Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, expect shows. And I will try to cover these stories there. Thank you all. Thank you all for listening. Thank you for those of you who participate in the Super Chat. It really helps. Those dollars really help. And particularly with the threat of who knows what the situation with Patreon is. Any alternative source of revenue is always appreciated. Also, stay tuned. I'm excited. I hope you are excited, too, about what Dave Rubin and the Rubin Reports and Jordan Peterson have in store for us in the days, weeks, months to come. I'm excited about it, and I'll definitely share what I learn as I learn it with you guys to the extent that I'm allowed to do so. Let me remind you to share the program if you liked it, to subscribe to my YouTube channel and to my podcasting app, on your podcasting app to my podcast, and, of course, to go to Patreon. That's what I've got right now. I don't think I'm on Subscribestar yet, although – again, any day now, it should be live, and support the show that way or through any other means. PayPal.me/Iran Brooks Show is another way you can support. You can't set up a recurring thing, but you can do a one-time gift, and I know many of you have, so thank you. Thank you all for listening, and I will talk to you on Tuesday. Bye, everybody.